Maria Lloyden emerged from the aircraft, changed into desert clothing, but Michael Rourke didn't think it terribly practical. She still wore a skirt, khaki, high-waisted, flared or gored or something of the size. He didn't know the terminology of female attire. It buttoned at the left side. Her top was a plain-looking white shirt, long-sleeved but with the sleeves rolled past the elbows. Her boots reached to her knees, and the tops disappeared beneath the hem of the skirt. Dr. Lloyden's hair was bound back with the same silk-looking scarf. The sun was fading as they drove with the young, rather unprepossessing Lieutenant Milton Schmidt. Schmidt's hero worship of Captain Hammerschmidt was ill-disguised. The group of them rode crowded in the jeep-like vehicle that Hammerschmidt and the other Germans called an SM-4. After some exposure to the nearly non-existent springs of the vehicle, Michael Rourke concluded that the SM in the designation stood for sadomasochism. The inventor was the sadist, the persons riding in it the masochists. As he considered his supposition, he noticed Maria Lloyden glance toward him from the front seat. They gave her presumably the more comfortable spot. She laughed a little with her eyes, then quickly glanced away. Other vehicles followed the SM-4. They were trucks that looked like the 2.5-ton trucks he had seen in photographs and in films. But these vehicles were half-tracks instead, and their front tires more massive.
Lieutenant Schmidt, where is the base camp?
We placed the airfield far enough from the camp so that should the arrival of the vertical takeoff and landing craft somehow be detected, it would not endanger the security of the base camp itself.
They stopped once when one of the half-tracks developed what turned out to be a minor mechanical difficulty, then proceeded. According to common time, by the face of his Rolex, it was well after midnight when they reached the tents of the base camp in a dune-sheltered depression well to the north of the landing area. What had happened to the J-7V aircraft after it had deposited them, he did not know. The other vehicles broke off as the SM-4 proceeded through the perimeter security. Michael assumed much of it was electronic because there were very few human guards. They stopped before the second largest of the tents. Hammerschmidt flipped out the rear of the SM-4 to the sand. He slapped his hat to his left thigh, then tugged off his goggles. Michael removed his goggles as well, as did Maria Lloyden. It was the first time he had seen her eyes without the glasses. They were very pretty eyes, and he told himself that had it been another time, he would have wanted to look more deeply into them. He jumped to the sand. Then perfunctorily helped the archaeologist down. She beat her skirt free of sand with the open palms of her hands.
I would suggest, Herr Captain, Herr Rourke, Fraulein Dr. Lloyden, that we take refreshment privately in these quarters I have arranged as a command center.
Hammerschmidt nodded to the junior officer. Michael Rourke stepped forward.
I'm hungry, thirsty, like everybody else, but I want to see that Russian position. How far is it?
The Great Pyramid is some 15 kilometers from our camp, Herr Rourke. But surely you don't mean to leave now.
I too share your eagerness, Herr Rourke, but refreshment seems in order, and the moon, it is too much full for us, I think. We should wait until nearer to dawn. Time will be more critical then, but light more favorable.
Michael nodded, only deferring to Hammerschmidt out of courtesy rather than deference to combat experience. Michael realized that merely by staying alive in that time of his boyhood, between the night of the war and the great conflagration, he was more experienced than any living man, except his father, except Paul Rubinstein, except Vladimir Karamazov.
Very well.
We will be working in the desert here. Our bodies will be ill-suited to it. But through my research, I have prepared for this as best I could. While we refresh ourselves, I can brief you.
The obvious thought crossed his mind. Maria Lloyden's eyes flashed toward him behind her round-rimmed glasses, then away. He had seen the look before in the jeep-like SM-4 and seen the look in the eyes of his sister. In his sister, he could accept it. In this woman, he did not.
All right, I'm starving.
The lieutenant opened the tent flap. Michael started into the tent after Hammerschmidt. He had seen the film Lawrence of Arabia and other films that depicted the vastness of the Middle Eastern desert. He read books depicting the Bedouin life, but nothing prepared him for the interior of the tent. It was air-conditioned, hermetically sealed, it seemed, from the desert, the ambient temperature almost chilling despite the drastic drop of desert heat as the sun declined. A table dominated the center of the tent, long, narrow, studded with camp chairs. Enlisted personnel brought in several duffel bags Michael saw removed from the aircraft, and prior to that transferred from the helicopter that took them out of Iceland. Other enlisted personnel brought forth food and what appeared to be wine. Michael tasted and confirmed that indeed the beverage was wine, but a trifle sweet for his palate. Maria Leuden, with Lieutenant Schmidt's help, began opening and unpacking the bags.
To state the obvious, the greatest danger in the desert climate is the sun and its effect on the body. The Arabs guarded against this in several ways, but chiefly in shielding the body from the extremes, reducing the effect of these extremes upon the body. I have had prepared clothing similar to that worn by the Arabs in similar situations.
Michael sipped at his wine. He wondered if it were non-alcoholic.
The kefir shields the head and the neck. The top of the head is the most susceptible portion of the body to heat loss and gain, except in some cases. I believe there are medical data proving...
Is.
Either is correct, since data is the plural form. At any event, for protracted periods of time in the desert, our health will best be served to take advantage of the knowledge gained by the Arabs over the centuries. For each of us that will comprise the team, I have had prepared a kefir.
She produced a large square of off-white material of what appeared to Michael's untrained eye to be a loose weave.
The kefir is held in place by this headband, which is called the akal.
It was made of various strands of cord running parallel to each other with large knots. She held the headband to her own forehead, the knots roughly at the temples.
And?
She set down the akal and reached for one of the other duffel bags.
For each of us, there is a jalaba, the robe. It may appear heavy and is made of wool, but it is this very heaviness which controls moisture loss from the body and shields the body from heat. It is loose, and after a time you'll find it comfortable. It can be worn open...
She slipped it on.
...or closed against the cold. And the desert at night, and in the hours before the dawn, can be quite cold.
Michael put down his wine. He'd come for more important things than a costume party. Paul Rubinstein sat bolt upright. He reached to his right in the bed. Annie was not beside him. There was no light from the bathroom. He threw off the covers and dropped his feet over the side of the bed. The rug was cool to his naked flesh.
Annie?
There was no answer in the dim light of the room. The white shadow of the large nursing shawl she used like a robe was missing from the chest at the foot of the bed. Paul found his Levi's and skinned into them. He found the long-sleeved, dark blue cotton sweater he'd worn earlier over his shirt and pulled it on. He stuffed his bare feet into his slippers. From the bedside table, he picked up the battered Browning High Power. He stuffed it into the waistband of his pants, then pulled the sweater down over it. He left the room. Because of the hour, he walked along the length of the corridor as silently as he could until he reached the double doors at the end. He stepped onto the small porch that fronted the steps leading down toward the gardens, which gave way to the central mall of the Hecla village. Annie sat, swathed in her shawl, on one of the massive stone banisters flanking the steps.
Hey, can I join you?
She turned around, as though startled, and smiled up at him.
Uh-huh. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to wake you up.
Paul jogged down the steps toward her, crossed to where she sat, then dropped down beside her.
I just,
What's wrong?
I saw it, Paul. I dreamed Madison was hurt. Was dying, and I woke up to the gunshots.
Oh, Annie.
He held her tight.
I saw it. And I dreamed again tonight. I don't want to dream. I don't want to, Paul. It's a curse. I can see things that are happening far away.
Remote viewing, they call it.
The library?
Yeah. What did you see?
Danny and Natalia. They were walking across the snow, following some depressions in the snow, but something was going to happen to them. And Natalia was very cold and...
And what, sweetheart?
And somewhere ahead of them, I couldn't see clearly, and I knew that they couldn't see at all, but there was something horrible. Death. I could feel it.
Her body trembled against him. Paul held her tighter.
Jesus, Paul, I...
We can't break radio silence, but we might be able to go after him. Your father should know anyway about Madison. Breaking radio silence might get him in worse trouble, you know?
Uh-huh.
All right, Listen, you get some things packed, cold weather gear, get the weapons ready. I'll go see Major Volkmer at the base. If that doesn't swing it, I'll get Dr. Munchen out of bed. Somehow we'll set it up, all right?
I love you.
Paul had nearly grown accustomed to the purple quality of the light in Hecla, but he noticed it now, noticed the warmth of the night in the heart of the dormant Icelandic volcano. He could smell the flowers and the plants and the scent of Annie, his wife.
I love you.
Paul Rubinstein held her for one moment longer. Dr. Munchen sat at his desk as Volkmer paced back and forth. Volkmer was a short, compact, heavily muscled man. His dark eyes seemed to be looking through the walls of Munchen's office, looking at no one as he ran his stubby-fingered hands through his thinning blonde hair.
I hardly think, Herr Rubinstein, that the dreams of an impressionable young woman who has just suffered traumatic shock are sufficient cause to dispatch a military expedition into hostile territory. An expedition whose very arrival might trigger the danger she so fears for her father.
Prior to the night of the war, both the Soviet Union and the United States were actively engaged in researching the practical military applications of certain phenomena in the field of parapsychology. Among these was what Herr Rubinstein referred to as remote viewing. There were some remarkably interesting results. Certain remote viewers with the proper stimulus could reveal details later verified by satellite and high-altitude observation photography, details of missile installations and the like.
Annie, well, she has, whether it's a gift or a curse, before Sarah or Natalia or John or myself were awakened back at the retreat, she saw Michael in danger, and she awakened us. If she hadn't, Michael would have died.
Coincidence?
Agreed. Possible. Natalia told me that she could almost feel something probing her mind for an experience she'd had years before where she used a knife to kill a man who was trying to, attack her.
Killed the American traitor Blackburn in exactly the same manner. Frau Rubinstein has conversed with me since the death of her sister-in-law.
Well, Annie, she saw Madison being shot, then awakened when the gunfire awakened us all.
Paul fell silent, eyeing Munchen's cigarette, wishing he still smoked. Munchen sat on the edge of his desk.
The Rocks are extraordinarily gifted in intelligence. That is readily apparent to anyone. Sarah, the wife of Herr Dr. Rock, her intelligence seems extraordinary. Combining the genes of the Dr. Rock and his wife, the possibilities exist. Couple this with the totally unknown effects of nearly five centuries of the mind functioning at a level of activity about which we know nothing. Could five centuries of development in a person of tremendous intellectual potential have achieved the crossing of a barrier? With the adults, it was difficult, I think. But with the children, the mind was fertile, raw material. It is likely that if Frau Rubinstein possesses this ability, young Michael may possess it as well. But there is greater incidence of special psychic awareness among women, and women, too, listen more easily, less reluctantly to their emotions, their feelings. Michael might well have such dreams and not even be aware of them. But Annie Rock Rubinstein is aware of them.
Volkmer leaned heavily against the wall of the office.
You believe, then, Herr Doctor, that I should cooperate?
It is my official recommendation, Herr Meyer.
How can you gamble otherwise? If John and Natalia and Captain Hartman are lost, we're at square one finding the Soviet underground city, aren't we? And you don't have enough forces to defend your homeland in Argentina, the Eden Project base camp, and the Icelandic communities if Karamazov should throw all his weight against one target. But if we can destroy his base, his power supply, then we must...
Herr Rubinstein.
Volkmer pushed himself away from the wall and crossed the room. He stood at the apex of a triangle formed by Munchen, Rubinstein, and himself.
Though you are not biologically a Rourke, you reason like one. Perhaps it is contagious?
The Great Pyramid survived. Somehow Michael Rourke knew it would. Maria Leuden brushed past him to peer over the rift of sand.
Mein Gott,
I thought religion was something rather new to you folks.
It is an expression, Herr Rock.
Ah, gotcha.
He looked along the ridgeline formed by the sand. Hammerschmidt and his Arab mufti, along with the sergeant and the five other German commandos, were positioned along its length, a heavy machine gun set up on its bipod. Michael sank below the level of the dune, staring back into the desert through which they came, 15 kilometers from the site of the German camp. The star's brilliance was slightly diminished here by the yellow glow of the Soviet work lights. Maria Leuden hugged the djellaba close around her, her head and neck swathed in a woolen shawl.
It was built during the Old Kingdom, but we don't really know much about the people who built it. The priest and historian, Manetho, some of his work survived in bits and snatches, but as recounted by persons living at least 6 centuries after he wrote, this was begun nearly 2.5 millennia before the birth of Christ. Why would this man Karamazov
hide a weapon here?
But don't you see? By some accounts, the pyramid may be vastly older than that. No one has ever really explored what may be inside it. Not completely.
Michael rolled onto his stomach and elbowed his way to the ridgeline again. This time, taking the borrowed German binoculars up from their strap around his neck, placing them to his eyes. They were electronic, allowing precise range measurement, precise measurement of object in view. He pushed the button for automatic focusing.
At the base, each side averages slightly over 775 feet. The height is 481 feet. The pyramid's exact dimensions were subject to great debate,
I know. The four sides aren't exactly equal, but rather seem to have been designed to reflect precise measurements of terrestrial geography.
He could see men moving about the Pyramid of Cheops, digging with hand tools.
Do you believe in the concepts of good and evil?
What?
He put down the binoculars and slid closer to her down the embankment, staring into her eyes.
Do you believe in good and evil? That they complement one another? Without one, we could not perceive the other?
Yes, I think so. But, Herr Rourke...
Fräulein Doctor, I've thought about Vladimir Karamazov for quite some time on and off. And quite steadily since his suicide squad caused the death of my wife and child. To kill someone who is very hard to kill, it's important, I think, to know that person. To know that person in as great detail as possible. There was little detail available beyond that which I already knew. Natalia, Major Tiamarovna, could have provided more. As his wife, she probably knows him better than anyone. But Natalia was unavailable to me. Instead, then, I carefully considered every fact I had, from as many different perspectives as I could. I came to the conclusion that in his way, Marshal Karamazov is the antithesis of my father. And I suppose of me as well, since everyone tells me I'm very like my father. Now, if we assume that what the Rourke family has fought for all these years, centuries really, is the objective good, then it's easy to concede that Vladimir Karamazov is the objective evil. But people who are diametrically opposed may have astounding similarities. Perhaps be so thoroughly opposed to each other because of these similarities. A similar trait in my father and Vladimir Karamazov is a simple and basic one. They are both fastidious planners, and both totally committed to succeeding in their goals. My dad, he was totally committed to survival, but not at the cost of integrity. On the other hand, Karamazov was totally committed to survival at any cost, having no integrity at all. And, unlike my father, if he couldn't win the game, he would destroy the arena. Therefore, we have assumed he is looking for some fantastic weapon. Maybe some super bomb, who knows? Now, if you expected all life on Earth other than your own to cease, and if you wanted some sort of special thing to be waiting for you centuries into the future, what would you do?
Put that thing, whatever it was, in the most secure place I could.
Yes, secure and accessible. Consider this. Coastlines could change, mountains could be blasted away, new ones could rise in their stead. The poles could have changed so drastically that compass coordinates would be useless. You wouldn't want a place that could conceivably be covered, obscured by snow or water or vegetation. All he's using the Great Pyramid for, Fräulein Doctor, is a landmark. What he wants is buried out there in the desert. What his men are doing is digging away to the base so the measurements are precise. He has coordinates and he could likely follow them to the exact spot. But like my father, he's planning ahead, just in case. Notice.
Michael jerked his thumb over the dune toward the pyramid.
They're only digging away at 2 corners. He'll shoot an azimuth off each corner. Where the 2 lines intersect is where the object, whatever it is buried. Surveyor's instruments, all the right equipment, he'll find it. Very soon. No matter how much sand has accumulated over it throughout the centuries, he'll go to the exact spot, know exactly where it is, and order the digging begun.
We should let him find...
Should we now? Let him find it. Probably. But we should be in a position to immediately prevent its use, and that's dubious. So we have to find it first ourselves and be waiting for him when he arrives. He has the digging equipment, we don't. Use the binoculars and look under those tarps to the west.
She crawled past him to the ridge, taking her own binoculars.
Careful so they don't see you, Fry.
Earth-moving equipment.
Yes.
But...
Whatever it is, it can't be buried too terribly far off into the desert, or they would have airdropped the equipment nearer to the site. It's not really needed here.
Then it should be something they'll find very rapidly once they've reached the base.
Yes, once they reach the base of the pyramid. So, any suggestions?
She slid down across the sand toward him.
Why do you ask me?
All right. Let me ask you something else. Can you read everybody all the time? Part of the time? Just some people? How does it work?
Maria Lloyden looked away. Michael thought her face seemed to flush with color. In the starlight and the moon, it was difficult to tell. It could only have been a shadow.
Only some people.
Anything special about that I should know?
No, not that you should know.
Well, all right. Have either of us had any good thoughts about what to do here?
You have. You want to penetrate the camp down there. See if you can locate the coordinates and get the approximate location so we can be waiting for Karamazov when he arrives. You have told yourself you won't kill him yet. Not until he leans us to the weapon. And you are angry with yourself for doing that.
Then you can read my thoughts all the time.
Michael, I mean...
Tell me what I thought.
I don't want to tell you.
All right.
When I was in my studies... Some of the ones with me who were in the youth, bridging into the SS, there was this boy. You're going to make me tell you, aren't you?
No. Never mind.
But I really want to tell you. I don't know why. This boy and some of his friends. Well, his name was Fritz. And Fritz tried to... And... I scratched his face badly. He surprised me in my room while I was shaving my legs. I used the razor across his face. He ran away.
Michael simply looked at her, saying nothing.
You're wondering what happens then. How does that relate?
Yes, I was. But you don't have to.
I know that too.
She took off her glasses and pushed the shawl back from her hair.
With some of his friends, he came for me. I didn't report him to the authorities. His father was very important in the SS. They came for me. It was the weekend. I wasn't expected anywhere until Monday. They beat me, only to stop me screaming, I think. They put tape over my mouth then. Fritz was studying medicine, and he injected me. Afterward, I found out they injected me 7 times. The drug was a hallucinogen, so my mind was someplace else. If there is a God, well, I thank God for that. Even his father's influence couldn't save him. Fritz and the others were arrested, tried. Fritz was killed during your father's assault on the complex. He was one of the SS men torturing Frau Stern. The drugs addicted me. It took months for me to recover. The residual effect of the drug... having somehow altered the chemical balance of my brain. At least that is what the doctors have said. But while I was recovering, it started. I could tell the thoughts of the young man I was engaged to marry. I could read the thoughts of my father, a professor at the university. I could read the thoughts of my girlfriend, Elsie. Elsie became a chemical engineer. There was an accident, a spill. Her body was destroyed by acid. I could feel her death. My father died of his 3rd heart attack. I could feel his pain when he died. I was in a coma for almost a week after that. And the young man I was intended to, after I recovered from the attack and the effects of the drugs, he couldn't live with the thought of a woman who had been used. He took his own life. There was no pain.
Michael folded his arms about her, and she leaned her head against his chest.
That That is why I was afraid when I found I could read your thoughts.
Michael looked down at her.
Read my thoughts now. Tell me my thoughts.
She looked up at him. The corner of her eyes were wet with tears. Tears flowed over the rims and streamed down her cheeks.
That I should not be afraid. That you won't die. That you are a Rourke. And so I should believe you.
Yes.
Michael crossed along the ridge with Hammerschmidt, the sergeant in command of the other five enlisted personnel. Maria Leuden accompanied them. Hammerschmidt had stripped away the Arab mufti. The sleeves of his shirt were rolled up past his elbows, and he was bareheaded. He had one of the German pistols in his right fist and one of the German assault rifles tight slung to his back. Michael left his leather jacket and his rifle behind. He wore only the two Beretta pistols in their shoulder holsters under his arms and the 4-inch model 629-44 Magnum in the flap holster at his right hip. In his right fist, he held the Life Support System 2 knife given him by Jan, the old sword maker. His palms sweated a bit. The moon was nearly down. In less than an hour, it would be dawn. They reached the end of the ridge of sand, the Great Pyramid looming high above them. Michael dropped into a crouch, a few meters from the nearest of the Soviet guards. Hammerschmidt gestured to himself, then to the guard. Michael shook his head. He gestured to the guard, then gestured with his knife. Hammerschmidt nodded. Michael was up, moving slowly, glancing from side to side lest he be detected. His mind focused on the image of the pyramid to avoid giving the guard the sixth sense warning his father John Rourke often spoke of. Michael kept moving, gradually increasing his pace, the knife held like a rapier in his right fist. Less distance now than the span of his arm, Michael leaped forward, his left hand going over the guard's mouth and chin, snapping the head back. The blade was long enough to pass through the body and exit. The weight of the Soviet trooper sagged against him. Michael gave the blade a twist as he withdrew it, letting the body sink into the sand. He glanced back. Hammerschmidt was already running to join him. With Hammerschmidt's help, Michael dragged the body up and into the depression beyond the edge of the ridgeline. The nearest wall of the pyramid stood 100 yards away. Men dug at the corner at the far edge of the wall. Michael gestured with his head toward Hammerschmidt, then toward the wall of the pyramid. Hammerschmidt nodded as Michael stabbed the Life Support 2 system into the sand to clean it of blood. Michael broke into a run at a right angle to the position where the Russian stood, heading for the near wall of the pyramid. He ran flat out over the open ground, finding running easier here in the denser air than at Hekla. He threw himself against the wall, flat. Hammerschmidt was beside him a second later.
Oh, Herr Rourke, we should cross behind the pyramid, I think.
Michael nodded only, taking off again at a dead run along the length of the wall. The sand was softer. He slowed still more as he reached the corner of the pyramid and edged toward it. With the knife sheathed, Michael took the 629 in his right fist from the leather. He could feel Hammerschmidt behind him as Michael edged ever so slightly around the corner of the massive structure. No one was visible. Michael looked back. No alarm. No one had noticed yet. Nor had anyone noticed the absence of the guard yet. He rounded the corner and ran along the next wall of the pyramid. With the revolver holstered again, his hands were weaponless. It was darker here, away from the glare of the yellow work lights, but the dark was shading a gray-blue. Very soon now, the sun would rise.
We found it, Comrade Marshall. It lies just beneath the sand.
I want it out before we go.
Michael slowed. He taught himself Russian from tapes, practiced it with Natalia, worked with Russian instructional tapes at Hekla in off moments. He could understand it well enough. Someone was talking with a superior officer, and one of the voices, somehow Michael felt, belonged to Karamazov. Slowly, Hammerschmidt behind him, Michael kept moving. His hands moved automatically, ripping the two Beretta 92 SBFs from the leather beneath his armpits. Hammerschmidt unholstered his pistol. Michael's thumbs edged up the ambidextrous safeties as he moved ahead.
Comrade Marshall, it should be a matter of less than an hour.
Tell the men to dig more rapidly. I wish to be out of here. Have what we came for.
But Comrade Marshal Karamazov, I do not think they're ready.
But Major Krakowski, have you considered that we might lose our historic struggle?
Comrade Marshal!
Michael stopped, a few yards back from the corner where the walls met. In his mind's eye, he saw Karamazov and the one called Major Krakowski just beyond the juncture of the walls. He waited.
We had anticipated the Eden Project alone surviving from the world before. But no. The Germans in what was Argentina are now allies of the Eden Project fleet. Allies of the Icelandic communities. The allies of Rourke. Mankind was more adaptable than any of us could have imagined. In a battle of concentrated military might, warfare between ourselves and the Germans and their allies might continue for decades unless we were to utilize the few thermonuclear devices still remaining to us. And if we failed to crush them with these devices, what would remain? Even if we were triumphant, huh? Could the atmosphere sustain the shock of a second nuclear war? I had prepared for this possibility. An ultimate weapon. I shall retire to my tent. When the diggers have reached the foundation level, prepare the transits for the sightings. I shall personally confirm their accuracy. Then we shall recover our prize.
Comrade Marshal.
Michael edged forward again, his fists tightening on the butts of his pistols. He could step around the corner and kill Karamazov now. But this weapon, whatever it was, if Karamazov were dead, perhaps Karamazov's underlings would still be able to find and use it. If Michael opened fire now, he would kill Karamazov, but he would be killed as well. Hammerschmidt too, then Maria Leuden and the others. And what little intelligence he gleaned concerning Karamazov's quest here in the desert would be lost. He raised both pistols, working the safeties down into the safe position. Michael Rourke closed his eyes. He felt Hammerschmidt's hand on his shoulder. Without opening his eyes, Michael nodded. There would be another time. He turned, opening his eyes, and with Hammerschmidt broke into a jog trot along the wall in the direction from which they came. They would take the body with them and bury it in the sand where Karamazov's force would never find the hapless guard. Let Karamazov assume what he liked as to the sentry's fate. Already, Michael was forming a plan, a method. Observe the engineers when they took the sightings with their transits, calculate the angle of the telescopes, and shoot back azimuths to locate the intersection point. It would be approximate only, but it would get them there. They reached the next corner. It was clear around the corner, no alert. The two men kept running. Jay clutched the thing that made fire. He remembered how one of his kind took a rock and smashed in the head of the one in black who came from the helicopter and took it, the gun. Jay ran. Moore or Char would take life for this, and Jay was not really certain if the gun would make fire for him as it had made fire for the one in black who was dead. When the snow came, cold came on the air as well. Smoke formed on his breath as he ran. Along with the gun, he carried the book with the pictures from which he learned to tell words. The book inside its box that felt cold to the touch, like parts of the gun felt. If only he could sling a web, like the one in the book, and move from tree to tree. He wondered, the one in the book, were there really tall places like that in the years ago? Were there people who lived inside the tall things with the spots that held the strange water in the walls? Jay looked back behind him. It was not Moore, but Moore's son, Char, and Char was running. In Char's hand was the club. It was not made from one of the trees with needles. It was made from another tree, which had no needles. It was strong enough to break bodies when it fell. Char waved the club over his head. Jay, his feet numbing with the cold, ran, holding the gun. John Rourke let Natalia sag against him as he studied the tracks in the gray-orange glow from the horizon. As the pre-dawn hours wore on, there were fewer and fewer tracks of the foot soldiers. He surmised more of them, with each opportunity, clambered aboard the armored personnel carrier out of weariness, sacrificing the warming exercise of movement for the respite from exhaustion. Ahead, the tracks veered off, out of the chain of valleys through which they moved, and along a gently rising defile. He estimated that if the Russians continued to travel, they would be by now at least 4 hours ahead. But his goal was not to catch them, just to follow them. He looked at Natalia and made his decision. Once they came up out of the valley and onto the ridgeline, he would find a suitable place, erect one of the climate-controlled tents, and give her time to rest. There was no choice. Her well-being was more important to him than satisfying his curiosity.
Come on, Natalia. Just a little while further.
I'm fine, John. Really, I am.
Sure.
He smiled, helping her along, flanking the tracks on the right, as he had done ever since taking up after the Russians. He couldn't figure out why the Russians folded camp and left in the middle of the night. Few things in any army ever made obvious good sense. Even so, why? They walked on, the sun winking above and below the peaks along the horizon as they moved and shifted their perspective. The light grew pale, washed out yellow. And as the sun rose, the wind, which had been all but non-existent, heightened. His own body was beyond weariness, on an adrenaline high, he realized, a high from which he might crash soon into exhaustion. As he scanned the tracks on the ground, he saw something else, a footprint unlike all the others, as though moccasined, and yet not.
What is that, John?
I don't know. Can you stand?
Yes.
John Rourke took his arm from around Natalia's waist and dropped to one knee in the snow. The sun was up over the peak directly opposite them now, and he could see the ground a little more clearly. Whatever the footgear, it was clearly the footprint of a man running. Rourke rose to his full height, fatigue forgotten for the instant. He peered into the gray light, another footprint, and another, and a similar track, only slightly larger, partially obscured one of the originals.
Two men running, either away from something or chasing each other. But what kind of footgear were they wearing?
Natalia stood beside him, a small flashlight in her left hand, its beam aimed toward the snow.
That is not Russian or German.
No, there's somebody else out here.
That's impossible, John. I think. I don't know.
Shut off the flashlight. Let's follow these a while if you're up to it.
All right.
You sure?
I'm sure.
He nodded, then started ahead, following the footprints slightly higher into the rocks. The lead prints and those pursuing, it had to be that, veered off left, in the same general direction as the tracks of the Soviet APC. The lead tracks were becoming more erratic now, the stride of the pursuing tracks longer than before. Whoever was chasing the first person was getting closer, Rourke surmised. There had been a fall, a hasty movement to get up. Then they ran on again.
Your PBKS with the silencer.
Yes.
Rourke reached to his right hip for the python, easing it slowly from the leather. They moved ahead cautiously. John Rourke froze. It was a sound like something he hadn't heard for 5 centuries, animal almost. A scream like something wounded. Natalia stepped closer to him. Looking at her for an instant, Rourke isolated the sound. The shock of hearing it was so great that the direction of its origin hadn't registered with him the first time. He broke into a dead run across the snow, Natalia behind him. Running in snowshoes was never easy, but it was even more difficult than usual because of the unevenness of the terrain, running along an embankment's course, then up. Rourke stopped. Cresting a rise, John and Natalia saw 2 men nearly naked, their skins rough and leathery, their bodies strangely non-human but very human, clad in strips of bark woven into ill-fitting tunics. One of them was powerfully built, the other slight of build but wiry. They were locked in what had to be a combat to the death, both men grasping, fighting over a Russian assault rifle.
Here.
Rourke stabbed the python toward Natalia, taking the PPKS from her right fist. He half skidded, half ran down the snow-covered embankment. The silencer on the PPKS, like all silencers, wasn't perfectly soundless. Rourke aimed the pistol toward the ground between the feet of the 2 men. Both of them jumped back. Rourke's eyes tracked the assault rifle. It was in the hands of the larger of the 2 men. He worked the PPKS's safety to drop the hammer and toss the gun.
Natalia!
Only amateurs or fools in movies threw guns around, especially loaded ones. Amateurs or fools, or people too desperate to have the time to do anything else. Rourke launched himself forward, diving for the midsection of the bigger of the 2 men. His left shoulder impacted the wall of muscle that was the man's chest and abdomen. The assault rifle flew from the big man's hands and into the snow. Natalia held her silenced pistol again. The big man's fists hammered down across Rourke's back, but Rourke didn't let go. His gloved hands were welded to the big man's hips. Rourke threw his weight left and down, and the big man fell. He caught a whiff of breath as he climbed on top and was foul. Rourke's right fist snaked upward, into position, then laced the big man across the jaw. Rourke felt his knuckles almost break. The head he struck snapped back, the teeth bared now, a hand crushing at Rourke's throat, a hand with a grip like a bench vise. If it was human, and he was sure it was, then it had to have testicles. Rourke's right knee smashed up. The man's left hand grabbed at Rourke's chest, closed over a handful of Arctic gear, and Rourke was airborne. The big man was up, doubled half forward, and Rourke got to his feet. The big man charged like a bull. Rourke sidestepped, wanting to kick, unable to do so with the snowshoes. Instead, he launched his full body weight against the man's right side in a slam. Rourke's right elbow snapped back into the side of the head. Rourke came to his knees now, balling both fists together. He clubbed them downward and across the man's jawline. The big man's body dropped to the snow. To be on the safe side, Rourke rolled back and unsheathed the Gerber MK2 at his belt. No pistol was near enough. The rifle lost in the snow when he first dove toward the man.
I have him covered, John.
Rourke edged back on his knees along the snow, then climbed to his feet. He sheathed the Gerber as he looked around. Natalia was standing by the other man. She smiled. He couldn't see her mouth for the scarf that covered most of her face. The sparkle in her blue eyes was all that showed the smile.
His name is Jay, and he speaks a kind of French that sounds like what you Americans used to call hog Latin.
Pig Latin.
Rourke looked at the slighter of the two men, at the woven bark clothing, the bark-strip footgear.
Enchanté.
John Rourke bowed.
Je suis John Rourke, mon ami.
The man smiled, sort of. Michael Rourke had gotten no sleep. The keffiyeh was a good idea, the sun already hot and not mid-morning yet. He lay prone on a ridge of dune more than half a mile distant from the Great Pyramid. Dr. Maria Lloyden, surprisingly durable enough to be beside him. Michael Rourke had used a bayonet-fitted German assault rifle, stabbed into the sand as a tent pole, and used the jalaba as a lean-to, rather than a robe, huddled under it except for the portion of his head and hands needed for using his binoculars, huddled under it with Maria Lloyden. Michael Rourke's eyes studied the surveyor's transit at the left side of the wall of the pyramid facing him.
They're about ready to put it into position.
I hope they hurry. It is very hot.
Michael Rourke looked away from the binoculars and at Maria Lloyden beside him.
I'm sorry if I'm a little abrupt.
I understand. It is a family trait.
Touché. But, well, we've been fighting this war longer than you and your people. This thing with Karamazov, it's not a military action to us, to me. It's a personal thing. He's almost killed my father and mother and sister and Paul Rubinstein, and what he's done to his wife, death is too good for him. What he did to my wife...
And to you.
You mean gut-shooting me and leaving me to bleed to death?
I don't mean that. Not that.
Michael looked away, through the binocular tubes, focusing a level of his attention on the surveyor's transit. Captain Otto Hammerschmidt would be watching the other one.
He robbed you of the only personal life you ever knew. You were always dislocated from humanity, that is clear. I have read our data on the Rourke family. Forced to be an adult from your earliest childhood. Forced to be responsible, to be competent. Never a chance to release, to be off guard. And then finally, that one night, you let your guard down a little. Or you believed that at least. And your wife and unborn baby were killed.
I see you and Dr. Munchen took the same correspondence course in psychiatry.
Correspondence course?
Through the mail. But you don't have any mail, do you? I got mail when I was a little kid. Christmas cards, birthday cards, letters from relatives. A person called a mailman, there were women too, would pick letters and all up from the relatives' houses and take them to a post office. The post offices were all over the country. At the post office, the mail would get sorted. When the letters to me got to my post office near me, our mailman would bring the letters to our house.
Do you remember what it was like to be a child?
Yeah. We rode horseback a lot. And sometimes it was cold, and sometimes it was raining, and lots of times Mama wouldn't eat because she'd tell us she wasn't hungry. And after a while I realized it wasn't that, just that the food was running low. There was a dog I played with on a farm, but the farm was attacked by madmen and there was fire. I used a rifle a lot, and I killed people, and this older woman there, she screamed a lot. Learned a lot about the human body. Saw human bodies bleed after I shot into them or stabbed a knife into them. I overcame my fear of seeing dead people because I saw so many of them. I saw dogs fighting over half-rotted human arms and legs. So...
You are hiding from me. Why?
I don't know what you mean.
You are attracted to me, as I am to you. But you feel that your wife has just died. And to allow yourself to feel anything for me would be wrong somehow. True?
I don't know.
And mercifully, they began to adjust the surveyor's transit.
Look, they're getting ready.
Michael learned, while watching the Germans build their base outside Mount Hekla in Iceland, that a surveyor's transit was no longer as simple a device as it had been in the books where he first learned of the device, or as it was in films where he saw one employed. His father owned a transit, and John Rourke used it to lay out the garden plot outside the retreat. It seemed a needless formality to Michael at the time, but he realized now that his father was trying to whet his or Annie's appetite to learn its use. Michael and Annie obliged. But these devices used no ordinary light and no simple eyeballing of measurement. If the Soviet transits were like those used by the Germans, and outwardly they appeared to be, they emitted a measured beam of laser light. For an operation such as this, where two transits would be used to locate an exact spot, each transit would give diode readouts for precise distance. When the beams crossed, the readout would indicate the nexus of the beams. Using such a system, their potential for error was slightly less than a centimeter at a mile, again judging by the German counterparts. Michael first intended to monitor the positions of the transit, but in the moments just after dawn, devised a still better plan. Mortars were in place that would fire smoke rounds on cue, and near the mortars, but not too near, were German transits, remotely operated, which would lock onto the nexus of the Russian transit beams and pinpoint the exact spot for the Germans. There would be a small show of force by German gunships, then the gunships would flee to the south, drawing any Soviet pursuit craft away from the German camp and the location of whatever it was Karamazov had come here to the desert to find. Lieutenant Milton Schmidt would lead this element, even picking up the mortar crews just to add icing to the cake and hopefully giving the illusion that the smoke was preparation for a hit-and-run attack. If the secondary laser beams of the German transits were sighted, the ruse might be discovered, but there was a more than substantial chance they would not be. After the skirmish with the Germans in withdrawal, Karamazov would be free to seek out his prize with even greater urgency since there was an enemy presence. Michael wore an earpiece leading from the radio unit at his belt. Hammerschmidt was on the other end.
Ready.
Ready.
There was the possibility that the Russians would hear the transmissions, but even if they had, it would be unlikely they would have the time to act. Michael Rourke knew that life was not a gamble, but a carefully calculated risk. He could not recall his father ever putting it that way, but it was the way his father lived. Michael reached up to the rifle propping the jalaba over them against the sun. He rolled onto his back, squinting against the indirect light of the sun. He removed the bayonet from the rifle and handed the bayonet to Maria Leuden.
Here, have a knife. Have a rifle, as a matter of fact.
He shrugged into the jalaba and refocused the binoculars across the sand toward the Great Pyramid. The laser transits were emitting light in the red intermittently. He could see flashes like bloodied shadows. The timing of the smoke would be critical, but the Germans had a device that served as a light agitation sensor. At least they had explained it as such. To Michael Rourke, it sounded like a fancy term for a laser light detector. He hoped. He watched.
Why haven't they fired yet?
It's not time yet. Be patient. Patience is a virtue.
But it's past...
Just watch.
When the battle started, he would move, but not yet. There was a flash of red stronger than before. There was a puff of heavy gray smoke, then suddenly clouds of the smoke billowed across the near face of the pyramid, and even with the naked eye, Michael Rourke could see the shafts of red laser light as they fired pencil-thin lines across the expanse of desert to the west.
Have it!
Michael grabbed at Maria Leuden's right arm, half-dragging her to her feet and after him. They ran, skidding, nearly falling, along the windward side of the dune and down to the waiting SM-4. The vehicle's engine was already running. Hammerschmidt's sergeant was at the wheel.
Jump! Quick!
Michael half-lifted Maria Leuthen into the rear seat, snatching the German assault rifle from her as he got one foot inside the front passenger seat.
Schnell!
Schnell!
Maria Leuthen had a map in her hands, searching for the coordinates Hammerschmidt had given her.
I've got it! A little over 2 kilometers. That way, Sergeant!
She gestured to the left of their line of travel.
Yes, follow, Doctor!
The man cut the wheel hard left. Fireballs rose in the distance near the pyramid from the diversionary attack of Lieutenant Schmidt. When Michael Rourke broached his plan, Maria Leuthen insisted on one thing, that the Great Pyramid in no way be harmed. With modern German surveying devices and X-ray techniques, its mysteries might finally yield to study. Destroying it would be doubly wrong, Michael agreed. Michael twisted in the seat, looking past her now at the billowing smoke behind them. Overhead, German gunships crossed low over the dunes, missiles firing. But the Soviet force was too large for the attack to be more than a gesture now.
To the left! About 30 degrees, Sergeant!
Yes, Fräulein Doctor!
Michael peeled away the keffiyeh, letting the wind catch at his hair. He ran his hands back through it, then stuffed the keffiyeh down inside his open shirt front as he slipped his arms from the jalaba. He reached into the back seat for his M16. He drew it up across his lap, resisting the urge to cycle the action and chamber the top round off the 30-round magazine already in place. In the bouncing, jostling SM-4, the chance of accidental discharge would be too great.
About 5 degrees to your right, Sergeant!
Yes, Fräulein Doctor!
On their right, Michael could see another of the SM-4s. It would be Hammerschmidt coming. To the west, he could see a line of the German mini-tanks his father told him of. He saw them for himself the first time in the desert here the previous evening. They were purposely cutting oblique angles to the target area picked up by the German laser transits to avoid leaving tracks that the desert winds might not quickly enough erase. And it was imperative to be out of range of Soviet gunships when they went off in pursuit of Lieutenant Schmidt's force. The gunfire was more distant now, the billowing smoke of the explosives, the occasional black and orange fireballs, merely specks on the horizon. He glanced toward the SM-4's speedometer, approximately 100 kilometers per hour. Michael mentally translated to miles. Something between 55 and 60 was rough, but good enough.
They're almost there! It should be that dish-shaped valley to the east of us!
Michael glanced back to Maria Leuden. The German assault rifle was across her lap, and in the sash around her waist she wore the sheathed bayonet. Hammerschmidt was to take the lead, and Michael could see Hammerschmidt's SM-4 disappearing over the artificial horizon of a ridge of sand. Already the sergeant was cutting the wheel to follow. Karamazov's forces would be airborne now, pursuing Milton Schmidt, but only a token force once Schmidt's withdrawal was apparent. Karamazov would be making his way toward the site of whatever it was he buried in the desert, and fast, Michael hoped. They covered the four SM-4s with camouflage tarps to avoid detection from the air by ordinary observation. More sophisticated techniques involving electronic surveillance would spot the machines, but they were far enough off the probable line of travel to the coordinates located by the transits that the likelihood of more sophisticated sweeps of the area was remote. Karamazov was noted for ruthlessness, not thoroughness. The mini-tanks were lost to him after the single sighting on the breakneck drive across the desert, but he knew their position would be 5 miles to the opposite side of the site, or approximately 8 minutes travel time. Three men were to be left behind with the SM-4s, men from Schmidt's detachment. Hammerschmidt, his sergeant, and the 5 enlisted personnel were geared up. Michael dismounted the rise of sand, satisfied Karamazov was doing as anticipated.
He's on the move. About 5 minutes travel time to the site. Those earth movers are slowing him up. Now here's what we'll do, as we planned it. Sergeant Decker, you'll take 3 men and the Fräulein Doctor and cut to the south. Captain Hammerschmidt and the 2 remaining men and myself will cut to the north.
We are ready here, Michael.
Michael Rourke nodded, his keffiyeh back in place against the strength of the sun, his M16 caught up from beside the SM-4, where he rested it. Mechanically, he checked the condition of readiness. Sergeant Decker and each of his men carried the German equivalent of Laws rockets with them. Each man carried 2 of the weapons slung over each shoulder, their assault rifles in their hands, their web gear festooned with grenades, fighting knives, communications devices, and a pistol. Hammerschmidt's detachment was equipped much the same. Michael took up a double brace of the rockets and slung them as the German soldiers had. He would learn Karamazov's secret, and perhaps have the opportunity to kill Karamazov. Michael wondered, somehow, if learning the man's secret might somehow be a greater punishment. Still, it wasn't that punishment Michael was most interested in. John Thomas Rourke erected one of the climate-controlled shelters while Natalia kept the big man covered. The big man was called Char. Je, John Rourke's French, was not good enough to make sense of the man's speech, told Natalia that Char pursued him because Char was the chief's son and Char wanted the gun. Char was unconscious still. John Rourke assisted in that with a powerful sedative from his medical kit. Compromising on the dosage between the man's apparent bulk and what it would take to put a normal-sized man out. Natalia seemed energized by the encounter with the men. She eagerly translated Jay's story. It was a tale that to John Rourke seemed at once believable and horrible. Among Jay's people, there was no oral tradition, no written tradition. Only Jay and his father and a few others, most dead, could read at all or speak. Jay spoke with Natalia. He accompanied each tortured syllable with gestures of hands and arms and face. Somehow, Natalia clarified his meaning. John Rourke watched Jay's eyes.
Where'd he get the rifle? I know he took it from Char's father, but where did Char's father get it?
He said there are many tribes like his tribe. That the ones in the black clothes and the helicopters had the gun.
How did he learn about the helicopters? Or are you embroidering?
Embroidering? No, I should have mentioned it. He spoke of a special book his father used to learn to read and speak with. Jay read it too. It was a comic book. Spider-Man? Here.
She opened the metal box Jay had set beside him. John Rourke glanced toward Char, the huge one's body starting to stir slightly. But that was normal for the action of the sedative. Across Rourke's lap was the python at the ready.
At any event, the ones in black, I assume forces from the underground city, have slaughtered his people for years. The really healthy ones are taken away.
Forced labor or experimentation?
Probably both. But I'd tend to opt for the experimentation. There would be little that forced labor of Jay's training and background could provide a technologically advanced culture.
Agreed. What else?
The gun. Some of the ones in black came, and one was killed with a rock. Char's father stole the rifle. The ones in black killed a considerable number of Jay's tribe and took only the younger of the women away. Jay's people are called the Blacks by the tribes to the south and west of here. Those tribes are naked most of the time, but Jay's people, because of the harsher climate here, wear the bark strip clothing, but the pigment in the bark darkens their skin, hence the Blacks.
Artificial race. How marvelous. Why did Jay steal the gun from Char and run away? Are they interrelated, cause and effect, or what?
Char and his father had been acting more brutal by the day in their treatment of the rest of the tribe. Jay's father knew that there was something more beyond their tribe, and that to improve his lot in life, Jay had to find it. Jay took the gun to spare the rest of the tribe the potential of Char or Char's father using it. And as a means of defense, since he was venturing away from the tribe and might encounter the ones in black. I assume Jay has no idea how to use the gun, beyond the fact that it runs out of firepower after a time, and the magazine needs to be replaced.
He's a pretty sophisticated fellow, actually.
You are right. We should be able to teach him his own language, French or English, without much difficulty.
Natalia dug into her pack, finding one of the thin, insulated blankets, similar to the Thermos Sportsman's blankets of 5 centuries ago. She placed it around Jay's shoulders. Jay at first drew back, but a characteristic of the blanket was the almost instant warmth it afforded. Jay stopped shaking and hugged the blanket around himself. Rourke doubted the origin of the tremors were body temperature. The bare fact of the man's survival here, nearly naked under such unremitting cold, indicated a hardness of nature beyond that of conventional men. John Rourke glanced again toward Char. The big man's stirring had not increased. The sedation was doing its work.
Does he know where the underground city is, or where the tracks of the Russian APC were going in such a hurry?
He knows the general location of the underground city. And if the ones in black were moving quickly, he supposes they were going to the Valley of the Helicopters.
Valley of the Helicopters?
I asked him about it. Apparently, it's some sort of base away from the underground city, and large numbers of helicopters, tanks, and equipment, at least I think he means tanks, are gathering there. Some sort of staging area. But that doesn't make any sense, does it? I mean, wouldn't Vladimir be, well, from what Jay tells me, the underground city is reasonably close, within a day's travel. I doubt Jay would run it. He doesn't look to have the stamina. But we can't be talking more than 20 miles.
We have to see this place Jay talks about as soon as we can. If it's a staging area, we have to find out for what. We can leave here in a little while, once I'm certain Char's sedative is wearing off properly, once he's starting to revive. We can't leave the man to freeze to death, and it would be a calling card to leave the shelter here. You get some sleep and tell Jay to do the same. I'll stand watch over our friend. You're sure Jay isn't just bullshitting because we sound interested?
I'm sure.
Rourke nodded, looking toward Jay. The wild man showed no evidence of cannibalism. There were sufficient plants in the area. It was conceivable a tribe that spent the greatest part of daylight hours on the prowl for berries, nuts, and other edible plant materials could subsist. The reason for Char's superior bulk seemed obvious as well. As the chief's son, Char shared in the royal share of what the tribe scrounged for food, while others, like Jay, barely had enough food to survive. The healthier ones of the tribe would, out of love or respect for age, care for those who could not as easily fend for themselves, as long as that were practical. Rourke studied Jay. It seemed that the young man was in his early to middle 30s, but Rourke realized Jay was likely only in his teens. People would die quickly here. It was a survival attempt gone wrong.